is, folks. Hi, this is Wayne Hancock, and you're listening to WHFR, Dearborn, Michigan. Hope you dig it, man.
Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science, interviews, and music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, 2-million-year-old fossils scientists say are linked to humans. A graphic novel that illustrates the life of phenomenal physicist Richard Feynman. And weird science of a beetle that takes on a frog. Here's a scientist soundbite.
This is what evolutionary theory would predict. This is strong confirmation of Darwinian evolution by natural selection.
Anthropologist Daryl DeReuter of Texas A&M University. More with him later, but first, science news of the week with Emily Howard. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you, Jorge. According to a team of scientists based at Michigan State University, we might be one step closer to an effective mechanism for cleaning up nuclear waste. The team has found that the normal digestive processes of a common type of bacteria, known as Geobacter, can reduce levels of uranium waste. It doesn't make it less radioactive, but it does convert the uranium into a form that allows it to be more easily contained and more safely stored. The study appeared in the September 6, 2011 issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
The U.S. space agency NASA announced on September 5th of 2011 that its Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has been orbiting the moon since 2009, has captured the sharpest images ever taken from space of the Apollo 12, 14, and 17 landing sites on the moon. The images show tracks from the lunar rover used in the last Apollo mission, Apollo 17, as well as the last footprints left on the moon by astronauts in the year 1972.
Researchers in Quebec have reported a link between pain relievers, such as ibuprofen, and pregnancy loss during the first 20 weeks. The research was published September 6, 2011, in the Canadian Medical Association Journal. Researchers found that women who filled prescriptions for what are called non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or NSAIDs, had a risk of spontaneous miscarriage that was almost 2.5 times greater than women who did not take these medications.
In other news, a medical team based at Germany's University Hospital of Jena has created an artificial nose for the purpose of smelling heart disease. This electronic nose works by detecting slight differences in odor molecules on a prepped portion of a subject's skin. At a meeting of the European Cardiology Society in late August of 2011, the German medical team reported that the e-nose can sniff out a bad heart condition from a really bad heart condition without using invasive medical procedures, according to the researchers.
In the state of Texas, which has been suffering from extreme drought for the past year, multiple wildfires began in early September. The fires were fanned by high winds over Texas, created by a cold front, which moved into the state just as Tropical Storm Lee was striking the Gulf of Mexico coastline further to the east. In 7 days, the Texas Forest Service had responded to 176 fires. The largest was in and around Bastrop, Texas, 30 miles east of Austin. More than 1,400 homes were destroyed by September 8th when a DC-10 air tanker was called in to help battle the wildfires raging across the state.
Science interviews after this. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. To hear from you on Facebook. Join our community. Find us as Earth Sky. Beth Lebwohl joins us with her story on a graphic novel about the life of the famous physicist Richard Feynman. Welcome, Beth.
Hey, thanks, Jorge. So I interviewed Jim Ottaviani, who is a writer, and he wrote a graphic novel, which you can think of as an extended comic strip about the physicist Richard Feynman. And Feynman, he was born in 1918, died in 1988, but he was one of the greatest physicists of the 20th century. I mean, there's essentially Einstein and Feynman.
Right, he won a Nobel Prize.
Yes, he is notable because he won the Nobel Prize for basically helping scientists understand the behavior of elementary particles, in particular, the interaction of matter and light. And he was not only a scientist, a physicist who worked on the Manhattan Project, building the first atomic bomb, won the Nobel Prize. He was also a great science personality. So he was an artist. He was a terrific science communicator. He was a bongo and, I believe, banjo player. And on top of that, a throat singer. I mean, come on, that's the cherry on top.
Yeah, Feynman connected with a lot of people who aren't scientists.
Yes, there. Yes, he definitely did. So anyway, this graphic novel basically tells his life story, but there are certain highlights. And one was what Jim Ottaviani explained were the Feynman diagrams, which contributed to his win of the Nobel Prize in, I believe it was 1965. And he explains that Feynman illustrated essentially with arrows and squiggles how matter and light interact. It somehow illuminated the behavior of elementary particles, which before that had been difficult to understand.
Kind of like a comic strip for light and matter.
Yeah, exactly. And a comic strip for scientists, exactly.
Science communicates in pictures. Feynman, in particular, was a very visual thinker, as exemplified by the so-called Feynman diagram. He was an artist himself. So the notion of combining words and pictures rather than just using words to tell this type of story makes a whole lot of sense to me.
He goes on to describe the nature of the Feynman diagrams. He said that when you talk about the behavior of elementary particles, things like atoms, things that are smaller than atoms, you have to consider that very strange things happen.
All these weird things happen. And his insight was to say, all right, let nature be nature and let nature do whatever it wants, as long as I account for all of it. And his work was such that he was able to do this in an elegant way.
So, you know, elementary particle physics is difficult to explain, and which is one reason he worked visually.
Yeah, and Ottaviani's taken a very interesting way of explaining how scientists do their work, writing comic books about Galileo, Newton, Niels Bohr, another famous physicist. What inspired Ottaviani to write about Richard Feynman?
I think that not only was he a brilliant scientist, he was a bit of a mischief maker, which will always speak to the creative spirit, you know. So in this next clip, he talks about Richard Feynman's safe cracking at Los Alamos. I mean, the guy was doing serious science and rather sobering science. He was working on building the first atomic bomb. And yet at this, you know, top secret facility, he would actually run around cracking safes.
And so, you know, if somebody had left for the day and somebody else needed a paper from one of their colleagues, they could go to Feynman and say, hey, I know Hans Bethe just locked this thing away and he's out for the day, but I really need it. You know that he would give this to me if he was here, so can you help me out? And Feynman would pretend like he had to go get a set of tools and things, but what he really did was he'd close the door, use this technique that he had for pulling off the numbers in a combination, and then open the safe and hand people what they wanted, or sometimes just leave a mischievous note that said, yeah, I was here.
And should you be wondering, he cracked those safes not with any sort of mathematical formula or anything. It was just by feel, which I thought was kind of cool. And this next and last clip was actually my favorite. I almost, like, cried in the studio. It's about Feynman's last years of life, actually, and he was diagnosed with cancer. He essentially reflects on his life in a spirit that was in keeping with the spirit of his life.
My absolute favorite sequence, though, is the very end of the book. The segment is called The Good Stuff, and Feynman is walking, like I said, in the hills near his home, with a friend named Danny Hillis. And Feynman has just had the diagnosis of cancer that, and this is the iteration of the cancer that is going to kill him. And he knows it. And his friends know it. And everybody knows this. But he's telling, he's just walking along, telling a story as he often would. And his friend Danny is looking sadder and sadder, and Feynman asks, "What's up? What's wrong?" And Hillis says, "Oh, I'm sorry that you're going to die." And Feynman says, "You know, I'm kind of bummed out about that too." Doesn't say it in those specific words, but that's the sentiment. But you know, after you get to be about my age, you realize that you've told just about everybody you know most of the good stuff that you know. And then he goes on to look around and say, "Hey, I'll bet I can show you a better way home from here." And he does.
Jim Ottaviani's book is called Feynman, illustrated by Leland Myrick. Thanks, Beth. Earth Sky's Beth Lebois. Find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Earth Sky, broadcast in over 1,200 stations, including Voice of America. Ryan Britton is back with some weird science. Welcome back, Ryan.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great.
Good, good. Well, today I have a story. It's a popular one that's making the rounds of the internet in a big way. Researchers at Tel Aviv University have documented an apomis beetle, or a ground beetle, successfully attacking and eating much larger amphibians like frogs, toads, and salamanders.
Frogs usually eat bugs, not the other way around.
Right, and this is a role reversal here, but it's actually happening, and the way it happens is pretty brutal. The beetles lay low during the day, and then at night they attack, and they bite the back of say, a poor frog, and it renders it paralyzed. Well, then it starts to eat the frog from the feet up, and I think by the time the frog feels anything, it doesn't have much of a body to do anything about it.
These ground beetles have an effective hunting technique, it sounds like.
It's very effective. Researchers actually put one beetle in a small cage with several amphibians, and it attacked them all and ate everything but the newts, which apparently it didn't have a taste for. But again, this ground beetle was very successful and consequently had some very, very big meals to enjoy. And that's the thing that actually amazes me, is that it's not a beetle necessarily attacking a frog. It's that it eats the whole frog. I mean, where does it put all that food?
It sounds like a bug-eat-frog world out there.
It is.
Ryan, where can people find out more about this finding?
Like I said, it's all over the internet right now. And you can look up Beetle Attacks Toad on YouTube to actually see the apomis beetle in action. There's also more information on the beetle at MSNBC.com and Discovery.com.
Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Earth Sky is Ryan Britton. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
Stones, follow the dirt all the way down to the bone. I'll be digging up dirt, covering stones, follow the dirt all the way down to the bone.
We're at Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. Researchers report in the journal Science that a new analysis of bones nearly 2 million years old found in Africa are evidence of a new ancestor to modern humans. Based on reconstructions from the bones, scientists say the new species has features both of humans and of non-human apes. Here to talk more about the fossils is Daryl DeReuter, a professor of anthropology at Texas A&M University. Dr. DeReuter, welcome.
Thank you.
What are the main findings of an article that you've co-authored in the journal Science that looked at fossils 1.9 million years old found in Africa?
Well, what we've done, we've actually published a series of five papers, our overall research team. And if there's an overarching theme that links all of these papers together, it is that these fossils are transitional in form. They belong to a species that we named last year. We named it Australopithecus sediba. And these fossils, these skeletons that we're talking about, show characteristics of both Australopithecines as well as characteristics that are later seen in Homo. The ankle bone looks very much like a human ankle bone, yet the heel bone looks very much more ape-like. And we see similarities in the pelvis, we see it in the hand, where it has a long human-like thumb, yet long Australopithecine-like fingers. It has powerful upper limbs, yet it has a pelvis that is very well adapted for striding bipedalism. The brain, although it is small like an Australopithecine at about 420 cubic centimeters capacity, the shape in particular of the frontal area of the brain is reminiscent of what we see in later specimens of Homo. So what we suggest is that this is an evolutionary intermediate between Australopithecines and then our own genus, the genus Homo.
What kind of analysis was done on these fossil remains of a 1.9 million-year-old ancestor to a human?
Right. We use a number of different techniques to analyze these fossils, everything from visual inspection to simple linear measurements to three-dimensional scanning. The skull itself was taken to France and scanned at the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility to give us extraordinarily high-resolution three-dimensional imagery of these things. We subject them to a variety of statistical tests. We compare them to virtually every other fossil we can get our hands on in Africa. On top of this, we had to do some very precise dating of the material itself. One of our papers provides a date for the fossils of 1.977 million, plus or minus 1,500 years. That doesn't seem all that impressive, but that is one of the most precise chronological dates that's ever been developed for a fossil hominin. I mean, we bracketed it down to a 3,000-year time span, which is remarkable at the 2 million-year scale that it's aged to.
And nailing just how old these fossils are, from what I understand, is an important part of the story in that this shows that it's older than the Homo erectus, which scientists are pretty sure that is a direct ancestor of humans.
Right. Homo erectus is the oldest one that most, if not all, anthropologists look at are willing to say that is definitely a human ancestor.
So tell us a little bit more about the significance of the, maybe a little bit about what scientists know of this creature and of the place where these bones were found in South Africa.
Okay, well, the fossils were recovered from a site called Malapa. This cave itself, Malapa, just happens to be the best preserved fossils that have ever been found in South Africa, because we have not only the cranium, not only the teeth, not only the jaws, but we have skeletons. We do know that the original cave surface was at least 50 feet above the ground, the bottom of the cave. So they fell into that cave, possibly alive, and then died on impact. There are some injuries that we see in the skeletons to suggest that they happened during a fall. Then they were very rapidly buried to be ultimately preserved for us to look at.
It's amazing. Dr. DeReuter, tell us about the big picture here. What do these findings mean for scientific understanding of the origin of humans?
The overarching theme that follows through all of the papers that we published is the transitional nature of these fossils, the fact that there are characteristics that clearly align them with Australopiths, yet in the same skeleton we have characteristics that clearly align them with the genus Homo, we interpret that to mean that these are intermediary forms, that they are evolutionarily intermediate between the earlier Australopiths and then later Homo. For me, one of the most important things is the clear indication of evolution by natural selection.
And what's next with this research? Are there plans to dig further in this area? What's next?
As remarkable as these two skeletons are, we have not yet begun to excavate the site. So far, all that we have done is remove blocks that were blasted by limestone miners in about the 1920s. We have recognized at least four other individuals. There are other young individuals and other adult individuals that we can see in the rock wall that we now need to start preparing out.
Hard work, but exciting.
It is exciting.
That was anthropologist Daryl DeReuter. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Our audio engineer is Eddie Campos. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Sleep Good, Built by Snow, 100 Flowers, Vanessa Lively, and The Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much heart, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us. Oh, but we don't know, but we don't know, but we don't. What you don't know won't hurt ya. What you don't know won't have you terrified. What you don't know won't hurt ya. Oh, but you don't know, but you don't know, but you don't.
Earth, sky.
We have a pretty rich and robust toolbox in chemistry. It's very opportunistic in many ways at this time in the development of the field to apply those tools to address problems of importance to society.
You are listening to materials scientist Joseph DeSimone, and this is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science. Dr. DeSimone is a chemist and inventor. He holds over 115 patents, ranging from an eco-friendly way to make high-tech polymers, such as Teflon and Gore-Tex, to a bio-friendly heart stent, to using the manufacturing tools of the computer industry to make new vaccines and therapeutics. He spoke more about the process of science and about what it's like to discover things and make things with Earth Sky's Jorge Salazar.
Dr. DeSimone, welcome to Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, your research spans a broad range of science, medicine, technology, chemistry, material science. How would you describe what you do?
We lie at the interface of a lot of different things, and I think at one level we're problem solvers, another level we're entrepreneurs. And at the end of the day, we're material scientists. We like to apply the capabilities of polymer science and new polymer chemistries to tackle problems that range mostly today in life sciences, but as well in some areas of colloids and material sciences.
I'd like to talk a little bit about one of your first breakthroughs, and that's in creating an environmentally friendly way to make high-performance plastics. These polymers you were talking about earlier. In this case, the plastic is Teflon. Tell us about what guided your research to be able to make this breakthrough.
When I was an undergraduate at Ursinus College in Pennsylvania, I fell in love with polymer chemistry, and we had some terrific teachers at Ursinus, and I really became enamored with polymers, and I decided to go to graduate school and major in polymer science and polymer chemistry at Virginia Tech. And when I was there, My PhD advisor, Jim McGrath, a terrific, terrific researcher and scientist and professor, he exposed me not only to polymer synthesis, that is how to make macromolecules, but we also got exposed to an emerging area at the time called supercritical fluid extraction. And this is basically compressed carbon dioxide. And it was being used in the food industry for extracting caffeine from coffee beans and so-called naturally decaffeinated coffee with nature's effervescence. And so we started fractionating polymers using supercritical fluids. And I thought, as I moved into my academic career, that wouldn't it be interesting to combine polymer synthesis with this supercritical fluid extraction process? And that became the foundation for how I launched my career. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that, as the business people will say, strategy is all about being different. And some of the most fertile ground for innovation lies between fields. So it really drove from that interface and then recognizing, you know, just why CO2 is useful in food processing, because it is natural, that it would be a green manufacturing process if, in fact, we could make polymers in CO2. And through a partnership with DuPont, we began making Teflon in CO2, and we pioneered that. And it was valuable and perceived to be valuable at that time, especially because DuPont was being hammered because of the environmentally unfriendly way that Teflon was being made at the time. And that this new method of using CO2 became a much more environmentally preferable way to make Teflon. And so that really launched us into a good run of about 15 years or so working in CO2 and doing a lot of different polymer chemistry in it.
Will you speak to the process of making things, something that you're very good at from what I understand? Two examples, the bioabsorbable stents, and also something that you're working on nowadays as well, these incredibly small and precise templates to deliver new medicines inside the body. Talk a little bit about this process of how making things can lead to innovation. What are your thoughts?
So the stent one was a terrific example and a terrific opportunity and experience. I met a man named Richard Stack, who is an interventional cardiologist at Duke University. He had shared with me this idea of having a bioabsorbable stent. He needed the polymer support and technology to help pull this off. And the challenge is daunting. I mean, most stents are metal. But, you know, sort of you look back and you realize that before there were stents, it was just angioplasty, you know, just opening up a blood vessel. And most people did okay with that, but sometimes those blood vessels would collapse and they needed to be propped open. And so a stent made a lot of sense. But why have a permanent prosthetic to a temporary healing issue? And that was the premise, and that was Richard's idea. And so we worked closely with him and developed a polymer-based stent that had the requisite mechanical properties to be balloon deployed and act like a metal stent, and then would provide mechanical support, but eventually would dissolve or degrade just like a bioabsorbable suture would. And then after a couple years, it's gone. And so it's pretty exciting to see it go from basic concepts in less than a decade into many, many people. And now what we're doing is bridging two other areas. So actually back in my PhD work at Virginia Tech, I got exposed to a technology called lithography. And lithography is a basis by which polymers are used to make patterns on silicon wafers to make circuits, transistors. And it's the backbone of the semiconductor industry. And what we're doing now is that we're harnessing the manufacturing techniques of the computer industry and applying those techniques to making new vaccines and medicine. And so we're basically making particles, delivery vehicles, that are extremely uniform. They have all the precision and uniformity of transistors, and applying that to making particles. And so now we have a platform we call PRINT, Particle Replication and Non-Wetting Templates. It's a particle molding technology and to make particles of controlled size and shape. And then we bring our chemical acumen and capabilities to design new chemistry such that we can make particles that are highly functional to do things that we want them to do. Deliver nucleic acids, deliver chemotherapy agents, seek out certain types of cells versus other cells. And so we're using these details of size, shape, chemistry, and elasticity to enhance the performance of vaccines and medicines.
You've been listening to Joseph DeSimone, the Chancellor's Eminent Professor of Chemistry at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and the William R. Keenan Jr., Distinguished Professor of Chemical Engineering at North Carolina State University. This Earth Sky podcast is part of the Thanks to Chemistry series produced in cooperation with the Chemical Heritage Foundation. Generous sponsorship support was provided by the BASF Corporation. Additional production support was provided by the Camille and Henry Dreyfus Foundation, DuPont, and ExxonMobil. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
The end of the world, put to music, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. As promised, a taste of DragonCon. The world's largest science fiction and fantasy convention came to Atlanta once again over the first weekend in September. We've got an extended excerpt of the session called These Are the Ways the World Will End, featuring astronomers Phil Plait and Pamela Gay. You'll also hear a song about that weighty topic. Bill Nye will report on his just completed trip to the Goddard Space Flight Center and Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., while Bruce Betts will step aside for a guest rendition of Random Space Fact, right after he tells us about the night sky and this week in space history. First, though, a conversation with Emily Lakdawalla about the latest moon mission and a 35-year-old 3D movie made on Mars. Emily, a couple of things to talk about this week. One of them, quite a psychedelic experience, but let's talk about GRAIL first. Not one, but two spacecraft on their way to the moon.
Yeah, this is a pretty cool mission. They're two absolutely identical spacecraft that were launched side by side on a single Delta II rocket that was, by the way, the very last Delta II that will be launched from Florida. There's only one more Delta II launch coming up from California, so that was the end of an era. Delayed a couple times by extremely irritating upper-level winds that had even the normally dry NASA TV commentators sounding exasperated. But finally it went up, and the most amazing thing about the launch is that they had a rocket cam on the second stage that actually watched as first one and then the other of these two twin spacecraft was pushed away from the second stage. I actually got to watch that live on NASA TV. I thought that was pretty amazing.
Now, very quickly, this is also a mission that should warm the heart of any geologist.
Yeah, this is special. It takes a look at the gravity field of the moon. The two spacecraft will orbit in the same orbit, just 200 kilometers apart, and will measure very minutely the distance between the two of them, which will change slightly as they go over areas with higher gravity and areas with lower gravity. And that actually provides a very sensitive probe as to the inner layering of the moon and where there's concentrations of heavier mass and where there's missing mass. And that'll really tell geologists a lot about what's inside the moon, not what's on the surface.
Now, let's move on, and everybody grab your 3D glasses, not the nice ones they give you at the movies, but the red and blue ones. Go to planetary.org, to the blog, check out a 3D movie from the 1970s. This thing, the vibe from this is just perfect.
Well, it has absolutely marvelous analog synthesized music. All of the Mars missions that have gone to the surface have carried 3D cameras, but this is the only movie I think I've seen that actually shows the surface in 3D for half an hour. And it's just marvelous. It's a very thorough introduction to the two Viking landing sites, which are, by the way, so much rockier than any other place we've landed since then. And also some pretty amazing video of a model of the Viking spacecraft sampling the surface and delivering the samples to its chambers. I actually learned quite a lot about how the spacecraft worked watching the video.
It really is just a perfect piece, including the extreme 70s narration that goes with it.
Yeah, it's kind of pedantic. And the narrator has this funny way of pronouncing stereo that I just chuckle every time I heard it.
Well, this works on many levels, so check it out. It's a September 9, 2011 entry in the Planetary Society blog. Weekend watching 3D movie from Mars. More than a half hour of it. Emily, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Matt.
Emily Lakdawalla is the Science and Technology Coordinator for the Planetary Society and a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. We'll be off to DragonCon in a couple of minutes, but first, let's say hi to Bill Nye, the Executive Director of the Planetary Society. Welcome back, Bill. It was my pleasure to accompany you on a trip to Washington that actually got started before I got there. You made a little side trip down to Goddard.
I did indeed. I went to the Goddard Space Flight Center, my first time there, and I saw the hardware for the James Webb Space Telescope. Say what you will, people talk about canceling and so on. It is an astonishing piece of hardware. Oh my goodness, these mirrors are solid beryllium and then gold plated because that's the perfect thing. So the idea is this telescope would be put in space above the Earth's atmosphere, way out behind the Earth along the Earth's orbit, looking at distant objects, the time machine of astronomers, looking at ancient light. It's quite a thing. Anyway, then the next day, as you know, Matt, you and I went wild. We went to the U.S. Capitol.
Went wild and got soaked also.
Yeah, it was pouring rain, everybody, just pouring rain. Many of the members of the Planetary Society and supporters sent us petitions. When you say many, how many do you mean? Over 22,000, I guess. So we took those petitions to their proper places. The House of Representatives gets delivered one way. The U.S. Senate gets delivered another way. And then we went from there. We did a luncheon for congressional staffers. Matt, do you think that went well?
I thought it went extremely well. Many of them are in the Science Guy demographic, and I think they probably were intrigued by getting to see you. But the great thing is that they heard terrific stuff from Jim Green of NASA, Planetary Science Division Director, and Steve Squires, Mars Exploration Rovers. And they just seemed to hang on every word. And we had one congressman there as well.
Everybody, we went there representing the Planetary Society, and we fought the good fight. You know, NASA, the largest space agency in the world, is under this big budget constraint. And these missions, when you try to send these things way out into the solar system to learn more about our place in space and seek answers to those two questions, where did we come from, are we alone? When you try to do that, it's just a complicated, expensive business. It is certainly worthy, because if we send those missions, we will make discoveries that I guarantee you, Matt, will, dare I say it,
change the world.
That's where you got it. And so we met with Congressman Lamar Smith, and we met with staffers from Senator Patty Murray's office. It was a really good trip.
Great trip. And if people want to see a very quick video of you in front of the Capitol with those boxes of petitions, it's at planetary.org.
Where else would you be? It's your homepage, isn't it, everybody?
Thank you, Bill. He is the executive director of the Planetary Society, also the science and planetary guy. And we'll talk to him again next week. Up next, our visit to DragonCon. Saturday, September 3rd in Atlanta, Georgia. The heat and humidity are just beginning to wilt the marching Klingons, fairies, Boba Fetts, Ghostbusters, and other assorted DragonCon attendees, but it hasn't stopped them from joining the parade down Peachtree that is a highlight of the convention each year. Fortunately, almost all the action is indoors. DragonCon has entirely conquered five of the biggest hotels downtown. This is no place for the claustrophobic. I can easily believe that there are more than 40,000 fans jamming most of the public spaces. I'm also immensely impressed and entertained by the costumes. 36 special interest tracks include a few real-world themes like science and space. Don't ask me which of these attracted the guy in the bacon suit. It's the skepticism track that has gotten me to a packed meeting room for the session called These Are the Ways the World Will End. Those wicked ways include planet-wide pandemic and supervolcanoes, but the majority of cataclysms came from outer space, beginning with gamma-ray bursts. You'll hear Pamela Gay, our guest just a few weeks ago on Planetary Radio, but first to respond is Phil Plait, the bad astronomer, another past guest. Writer Scott Siegler also chimes in.
Well, I spent 5 years studying them, so why not? There are a lot of different ways of making them, but they are essentially gigantic explosions when stars die, and one of them is caused by a very supermassive star that blows up as a supernova, but in the core of the star, the core collapses down. The outer parts blow outward. The inner parts collapse down and form a black hole. And all kinds of things happen that are very complicated and take way more than 3 minutes and 28 seconds to describe. And so you get a disk of material that swirls around the black hole, and that focuses twin beams of matter and energy that shoot out of this thing at approximately the speed of light. The amount of energy in these beams is beyond comprehension. It's as if you took the entire sun's lifetime output of energy over 11 billion years lifetime of the sun and compress it down into a beam that is basically going to last a few seconds. And so anything in the path of this beam is going to get vaporized for a ways. As the beam goes, it spreads out, and as it moves across the galaxy, the energy in the beam gets spread out so that it's not as deadly. So it turns out that if one is about 7 or 8,000 light years away, the number's a little squishy, but it's that kind of distance, it's far enough away that it doesn't hurt us. The good news is we don't think there are any stars that close to the Earth that can do this. The bad news is there are two that are right sort of kind of on the edge of that. The good news is they might not be pointed at us. The bad news is they might be. We don't think that the stars that can do this form in the current universe. We see these things really, really, really far away where they can't hurt us. And we think the conditions in the universe back then were different and could form these things better. There's not much to say about this, except I did the calculations years ago where if I said, what if one of these things were 100 light years from the Earth instead of, 100 billion or 100 million, what would happen? And it turns out it would be like blowing up tens of millions of nuclear weapons all over the side of the Earth facing the gamma ray burst. So that would be bad. There's not much you can do about that, actually.
Can you stop, drop, and roll? Will that fix it?
Yeah. Stop, drop, and be nucleated down to your subatomic.
Just particle. Duck and cover.
Yeah. So. Duck and vaporize, I believe, is the term now.
So one of the fascinating things about these things is it makes you remember the sun is moving. Because while there's none nearby now, every 135 million years, we go all the way around this Milky Way galaxy that we live in. Get new neighbors along the way, and some of them might be less well-behaved. So while we do believe there probably aren't any stars forming in the modern universe, we've been proven wrong on things like this before. So it could be 70 million years from now, another part of the galaxy, boom, we're dead.
I'll add that there's circumstantial evidence that the trilobites in the Ordovician extinction, did I get that right?
Yeah.
May have been wiped out by a gamma ray burst. It's not conclusive at all. It's interesting. And also there's concrete evidence that a nearby supernova blew up near the Earth about 2 to 3 million years ago. There's the presence of a radioactive isotope of iron in the bottom of the ocean that's been picked up in sediments that's much higher than normal. And this isotope, iron-60, is only created in supernova explosions. And there had to have been one nearby to get that to the Earth before it decayed away. So 2-3 million years ago, there was probably something in the sky that blew up, and it was very close, probably... certainly within 100 light years. This is pretty amazing.
In case you missed it, that means it rained stardust. And that stardust is on the bottom of the ocean right now.
Not a lot, but enough.
But still, it rained stardust.
Yeah.
Cool.
And the street value of that stuff is through the roof.
Yeah. I'll just want to put it on eBay.
We've got more from These Are the Ways the World Will End at DragonCon. This is Planetary Radio.
I'm Robert Picardo. I traveled across the galaxy as the Doctor in Star Trek Voyager. Then I joined the Planetary Society to become part of the real adventure of space exploration. The Society fights for missions that unveil the secrets of the solar system. It searches for other intelligences in the universe, and it built the first solar sail. It also shares the wonder through this radio show, its website, and other exciting projects that reach around the globe. I'm proud to be part of this greatest of all voyages, and I hope you'll consider joining us.
You can learn more about the Planetary Society at our website, planetary.org/radio, or by calling 1-800-9-WORLDS. Planetary Radio listeners who aren't yet members can join and receive a Planetary Radio t-shirt. Our nearly 100,000 members receive the internationally acclaimed Planetary Report magazine. That's planetary.org/radio. The Planetary Society, exploring new worlds.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. The gigantic DragonCon fan event dominated downtown Atlanta over the Labor Day weekend. We are sampling just one of hundreds of events, a panel discussion about the ways the world will end. Moderator Rebecca Watson was ready to move on from gamma ray bursts to those big space rocks coming our way. You'll once again hear astronomers and science boosters Phil Plait and Pamela Gay.
asteroid impact.
We're still doing astronomy?
Yes, yes. We're going to go to this one.
This is why there's two of us.
Yeah, sure, but we have other topics that aren't astronomy, but we're going to go to asteroid impact.
Tag me in.
Tag you.
Okay, I'll start. I like this one. This is something that will happen eventually if we don't prevent it. As I like to say, you could ask a dinosaur, but you can't. And there's a reason for that. So there are these asteroids out there, and let me put it this way. There's debris hitting the Earth all the time. About 100 tons of material hits the Earth every single day. That sounds like a lot, but it's not. It's actually enough to fill, I think, this room in about a month. It's a number something like that. I can't remember off the top of my head. But the point is, whenever you look up and see a shooting star, that is debris hitting us. It's a little tiny piece. But there are bigger pieces out there. You know, something the size of a beach ball or a sofa will burn up harmless in the atmosphere. But when you start to get to be about the size of this room or bigger, it actually can blow up high in the Earth's atmosphere, create a flash of heat and a shock wave that can start fires and knock down buildings. And by the time you get to something that's roughly 30 to 40 meters across, 50 meters across, you're talking about 10 to 20 megaton yield explosion, something like the largest nuclear weapons we've ever blown up. And as they get bigger, you can do the math. So the point is, we don't want these things to hit. So you have to know they're out there, which we do. We have to find them, which we're working on. We have to understand how to prevent them from hitting us, which is something we're also working on. And then we have to do it. And it's the doing it part. It's this part that we're having some trouble with. It is possible. I won't go into details because there's not enough time. But there are a myriad of ways of getting these things out of the way. You can smack them with a space probe. You hit them, and that pushes them out of the way. Land a probe near it. Like, here's a probe, here's an asteroid, and then the gravity of the probe can actually tug the asteroid out of the way.
Don't land it, put it near.
Yeah. These things are spinning, they're tumbling, and so if you land on it, it's really hard. There are a lot of ways to do it. It's not hugely expensive. It'd probably be $1 billion, something like that, less than the cost overruns on James Webb Space Telescope, I'll put it that way. That's probably a bad analogy. But the point is, we can do this if we have the will to do it. And I don't want to have to say, gee, I wish we had done that before that thing was in our sky.
Yeah. And the Dawn mission just totally proved we have the technology to do this. We went out, we caught up. This was the most awesome orbital insertion ever. The mission goes out, and it's creeping up, gets up on Vesta, and they're matched in their orbital speeds. And then they trying to orbit something that has that little gravity is a bitch. So they sneak up on it and then try to orbit it, and they had the plan of, well, if we miss this time, we can just try in a few more days. So just the fact that you have to sneak up on it, match its speed, and then very carefully trying to get into orbit around it, we've proven we can do that. So we know we can get something near it and pull it gravitationally. Now, you see pictures of Barringer Crater, you hear death of the dinosaurs, but it's hard to really understand what asteroid impacts do until you really start studying craters. And I've been working on a project with the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter to look for all sorts of features in lunar images. And the image that brought it all home to me was one of boulders on the moon. To get a boulder on the moon, you throw a giant rock asteroid at the moon. It digs into the bedrock and hurls chunks of bedrock. So giant asteroid came in, threw a chunk of bedrock, hit. Later, another one comes along, repeats the process, throws a second boulder that lands, starts rolling down a hill, hits the first boulder, and split. The universe plays pool with boulders on the moon by hurling asteroids at its surface. I will never forget Dragon Con 3 or 4 years ago, Phil talking about asteroids hitting the Earth and showing the artist's rendering, and a small child bursting into tears in the back of the room thinking it was real.
Thank you for reminding me of that, too. That was an awesome moment in my life.
It was a life lesson for all of us.
Yeah. Phil Plait and Pamela Gay on the near-Earth object that may ruin our whole day. But wait! The 2011 DragonCon session began with a special treat. Podcast host and musician George Rabb teamed up with Phil to present this not-quite-cheery tune about the ways the world will end. We bring it to you now with their compliments.
The ways the world will end, these are the ways, these are the ways the world will end.
Odds of dying by asteroid impact, 1 in 700,000.
The overall risk of dying from an impact in your lifetime is 1 in 700,000, somewhat less than being killed by a fireworks accident, but still more probable than being killed on an amusement park ride or by an act of terrorism.
These are the ways the world will end. These are the ways the world will end. These are the ways. These are the ways the world will end.
Odds of dying by supernova explosion. 1 in 10 million. Supernovae happen about once per century, and I'm glad you like that too, in any given galaxy. Assuming the event could cause a mass extinction killing everyone on Earth, the odds of you specifically dying from one during your lifetime are about 1 in 10 million.
These are the ways the world will end. These are the ways the world will end. These are the ways. These are the ways the world will end.
Odds of dying by solar flare or coronal mass ejection. 0, but with an asterisk. While a whopping big solar event can seriously impair or destroy a nation's infrastructure and economy, in general, it would not directly cause deaths. We have to rate this a 0 chance for human fatality, but with an asterisk, as a nod to the destructive power it has in other ways.
These are the ways the world will end. These are the ways the world will end. These are the ways. These are the ways the world will end.
Odds of dying by gamma ray burst, 1 in 14 million. Gamma ray bursts are dangerous from distances of more than 7,000 light years. You would have to be in the path of a relatively narrow beam to get hurt. Your odds of being killed by a GRB are then 1 in 14 million. You're about as likely to be killed by a shark attack.
These are the ways the world will end. These are the ways the world will end. These are the ways the world will end. These are the ways the world will end.
Eventual odds of dying by death of the sun, inevitable.
These are the ways the world will end. These are the ways the world will end. These are the ways. These are the ways the world will end.
Eventual odds of dying by galactic doom, inevitable.
These are the ways the world will end. These are the ways the world will end. These are the ways the world will end.
Eventual odds of dying by death of the universe. Correct.
These are the ways the world will end. These are the ways, these are the ways, these are the ways the world will end.
George Robb, everybody.
George Robb and bad astronomer Phil Plait singing us out of the 2011 Dragon Con in Atlanta, Georgia. By the way, DragonCon is also where Planetary Radio won its Parsec Award for Best Podcast with the Facts Behind the Fiction. Back in a moment with Bruce. Bruce Betts is here. Time for What's Up? Connecting via Skype once again this week. I have yet another present for you, but I'm not going to even mention it until I can show it to you in person, because I just know we're going to get a great reaction.
I'm still so excited from the last one, the little tiny Saturn V.
Yes, and how appropriate for the trivia question answer that we will be providing this week. What's up?
Well, we've got Jupiter dominating the evening sky, coming up in the early to mid-evening in the east, and then it's this super bright star-like object over in the east through the rest of the evening. And we've got Mars, still kind of dim, but up there in the pre-dawn, rising after midnight, and high in the east and before dawn itself. But there's other good stuff coming up in the weeks to come, so stay tuned.
Just a tease.
I'll give a little something more. I like when the pretty pictures of the moon next to a planet. So you can see the moon next to Jupiter on September 16th and the moon near Mars on September 23rd.
Okay, hopefully plenty of warning there.
There you go. This week in space history, we had another debut. I know we just talked about Star Trek last week, but in 1965... This one, you can probably get it this time.
Yeah, because I guessed it the last time, right? Lost in Space.
Danger, Will Robinson.
It actually preceded Star Trek by a year. Amazing. And Robbie the Robot, you know, the robot that you were just quoting from Lost in Space, I think he was that robot's uncle. Just by accident, I caught Forbidden Planet a couple of weeks ago on Turner Classic Movies, and there was Robbie. What a great robot.
He is a fine, fine robot. It was also in 1976, the first rollout of the Shuttle Enterprise, the glide test shuttle.
Oh, yes, right. I think I was there.
Really? And Saturn's moon Mimas was discovered in 1789. We'll come back to that.
I wasn't there.
I don't believe you. Let us now go on. And I hear you've recorded some fabulous guests for us.
Yeah, you can rest the vocal cords this week. One of the things that happened at Dragon Con that we were reporting on earlier in the show was a, get this, space trivia contest. Only the second year that they've done it. Guess where they got the idea. No, actually, I didn't ask if they stole it from us. But it was pretty fun. Kind of a game show format. I got the four finalists together afterward to do this. What is your name, sir?
Alexander.
And you beat out last year's champion. You got in on this just because you're the returning champ, right?
I did. I was the only champion. Now we're the only two winners ever of the track, so we'll take it.
And your name is?
I'm Andy Dykes.
Yeah. And how about you?
Julia Naylor.
Uh-huh. Corey Greenwald.
Well, congratulations to all of you. To what do you owe your incredible vast knowledge of space trivia?
Wikipedia. 2 degrees in aerospace engineering. I worked at NASA for 5 years. I worked at space camp for 3 years, and I now work at Intelsat flying commercial satellites.
What's your excuse?
Space camp.
Woo, space camp.
Sirius XM radio. 40 years of Star Trek.
Live long and prosper. Okay, you know what I want you to do now? You ready? On three. One, two, three.
Random space fact.
There you go, Bruce. And they didn't win a T-shirt.
Wow. That was nice.
Yeah, they were good sports.
Thanks to them, oh, trivia winners. Here's a random space fact. The sun is a nearly perfect sphere. Its polar diameter differs from its equatorial diameter by only 10 kilometers. This much different than, say, the gas giant planets that are quite flattened and due to rotation and spinning and such.
And even better than our own planet, right?
It is. We don't have much, but we do have some. So, yes, it is. It's so spherical. It's just beautiful. We move on to the trivia contest. And as we teased, we talked about the Saturn V rocket. I asked you, what mission was the first flight of the Saturn V rocket? How'd we do, Matt?
Quite well. Big reaction to this one. Go ahead and give us the answer, and then I'll tell about the guy who's won a T-shirt this week.
It is the unmanned Apollo 4 mission, launched November 9th, 1967.
And what a mission it was. I mean, there really had never been anything like that launched. We heard from John Gallant, who quoted some interesting stuff here, that it was, you know, the full-on rocket, the vibration, the shockwave set up by that mighty first stage with its five big engines, shook the CBS broadcast booth so badly that ceiling tiles were falling on Walter Cronkite. He actually had to brace the big picture window looking toward the launch because he was afraid it was going to shatter. Which is, you'd think they'd have some flunky do that, not the world's most trusted anchor person.
Jack of all trades, he was.
I guess. So David Musa is our winner this week. David Musa of Huntington, West Virginia. First-time winner, I believe. And congratulations, David. We'll send you a shirt.
Congratulations, and for your chance at winning a shirt, a Planetary Radio fabulous shirt, tell us who discovered Saturn's moon Mimas. Go to planetary.org/radio, find out how to enter.
And you have until September 19, that's Monday the 19th, at 2 p.m. Pacific time.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, think about shock waves of all different kinds. Thank you, and good night.
I'm shocked, shocked to learn that there is a trivia question going on in this program. He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society, who joins us every week for What's Up. Next time, a young scientist who builds galaxies for a living. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and made possible in part by a grant from the Kenneth T. and Eileen L. Norris Foundation and by the members of the Planetary Society. Clear skies.
The WHFR Monday Forum, an hour of a wide variety of one or more talk show programs from 6 to 7 p.m., some of which are locally produced.
Today turns into yesterday, leaving only words we say for this time.
New ideas and information, different each week, not available on other Detroit stations. That's why we're the station making waves, WHFR.fm. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to whfr@hfcc.edu.
The good times, the hard times, this time is our time.
The WHFR Monday Forum, 6 to 7 p.m. And also listen to all locally produced talk shows on WHFR Tuesday Forum from 1 to 2 p.m.
Hello, you are listening to WHFR Dearborn, and it is time for Just a Little Indie. Yes, I know that you're excited. Today, well, this whole week actually, is a very special week here at WHFR. It is GPS week. That means everybody is celebrating places, or, you know, their interpretation of places you can go, things you can do, you know, whatever, somewhere that you can get to, typically using a GPS, you know, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. It's up to our interpretation, and hopefully you will stay tuned to hear